quite a significant increase in the number of the children and families that are food insecure, something that we haven't seen for 50 or 60 years at this kind of scale.
Thank you for that, Professor. Well, Mohan, you know, some truly worrying times for the children of Britain. I'm going to skip what I have written down here, and because you made a comment that not a whole lot has really changed from 20, 25 years ago. Maybe the depth of the problem is a little bit more now. Can you elaborate on that a little bit and put it into perspective for us?
Sure, but I mean, food poverty has been a long-standing issue in the UK. I mean, some people trace it back to the late 1970s, the transition from, you know, kind of quasi-socialist regimes of the Labour Party to Margaret Thatcher, who brought in kind of extreme conservatism and so-called the Thatcherite brand of economics. So it's a long-standing issue, and I think it's one that successive governments clearly have not been able to get on top of, and by all credible accounts, it's got worse recently.
Okay, very well. Yeah. We're going to continue on that trend after a little bit as it goes by here. Now, we're going to take a look now at this next report. This next report studies why so many famous faces in the UK are lobbying the government to take action against child hunger and also poverty.
It was not just the parents of children who took to the likes of social media to complain about the shocking food packages that were being made available to British children stuck in poverty. A host of famous faces took the problem on and used their positions and influence to drill home the message to the government that current measures being taken were simply not enough. One of the most prominent campaigners against the treatment of children in poverty in the UK is Manchester United and England footballer Marcus Rashford, who is a young man experienced and lived through the tough times firsthand that are still being seen across the UK today, as explained by Marcus Rashford's very own mother in a recent interview.
I had three jobs, and if I didn't do that, we just wouldn't have been able to cook a pot of food. It's just a bit difficult. So Marcus is only telling the story from how he sees it from, and the words that he's been saying, they obviously come from the bottom of his heart.
Such was the impact of Marcus Rashford on child food poverty in Britain that Boris Johnson and his ultra-elite rich boy cabinet was forced to listen and overturn the draconian measures, earning Marcus Rashford recognition from the Queen in his work in fighting child poverty. It's also seen many others take inspiration from the footballer, and all have contributed in their own way.
This campaign by Marcus Rashford, who is an absolute legend for what he's doing, he's stuck to his roots, and this is our inspiration. I think this is most of the cafes, restaurants around the country are doing it because of him. We have to feed our children.
But in spite of the many famous faces doing their bit to tackle food poverty in Britain, the problem does not just lie with food, as poverty in the UK is much wider and deeper than meets the eye, and is a problem that, according to one volunteer, sees the blame lying solely at the feet of the British government, who have allowed cuts, austerity and mismanagement to bring the people of Britain to their knees as they beg their way out of poverty.
It's not an easy thing to tackle, and it's not just food poverty, it's poverty as a whole. So we're coming back from years and years of austerity. Funding has been cut for so many different services. It's about reinvesting in the community.
Joining me back in the studio is Mohan Abedin and Professor David Gordon from the University of Bristol. Okay, Mohan, welcome back.
Welcome.
Let me go to the professor first. Professor, some famous faces have stepped in to talk about this very important issue of child poverty. You have the likes of people like Marcus Rashford, you have Tom Kerish. Why should it take such famous celebrities to finally come about and raise awareness and finally kickstart some form of action to be taken in tackling this very important issue?
Well, academics have been warning, and NGOs have been warning about this problem for some time. It's although the pandemic has brought it into sharp focus, it's been a growing problem for 10 years or more. The government has been pursuing policies of austerity, and they've been squeezing benefits for those of working age, particularly families with children. And in particular, there have been some rather punitive changes to the welfare budget, particularly for families who are reliant on welfare benefits, who have more than two children or who have extra rooms in their household. The government has really squeezed their incomes. Now, during the pandemic, they've raised those welfare benefits for some families, but again, these kinds of ideological squeezes on the incomes of some of the poorest in society are still in place. And it's taken celebrities to complain in order for the government to suddenly wake up to these problems. They've just ignored all the NGOs and academics and been able to do that because Brexit's so dominated the political debate. But the pandemic, reality has hit because of the pandemic, and there is a genuine and real dire problem. In one of the richest countries in the world, there should not be a problem of feeding children. It's something that you might expect in sub-Saharan Africa or parts of Asia, but in the UK, it's a scandal.
Okay, thank you for that, Professor Mohan. Let's turn our focus to Marcus Rashford becoming a thorn in the side of the Tory government, it seems, as his campaigns have led to numerous U-turns by Boris Johnson, for example, and earned him an MBE in the process. Why does Marcus Rashford, or anyone for that matter, actually keep defeating public policies that are set by the Conservatives, do you think?
Well, I'm not sure he's actually defeated a public policy, because the policy is still in place. The policy is to, quite literally, to starve people who can't afford it. Because as the professor rightly said, the UK has all the resources it needs to feed everybody in the country. But for ideological, political, and I would actually say cultural reasons, they're choosing not to do that. So they would prefer for kids to literally starve than to provide this universally. Now, Marcus Rashford, of course, he's a celebrity, so he's highlighted this issue. But I suspect that this is going to be a transitory thing. Somebody else may occupy his place. The real issue here is just the whole privatization of everything, including the provision of school meals for children. Now, not just a few weeks ago, a private company was actually paid £35 per school meal. Okay, so they were given this tranche of money by the government, and out of that £35, they actually spent £5 on the school meals, and they pocketed the balance. So the result was these grubby meals. Whereas for £35, you could provide a lavish meal.
What were the grubby meals? What were they provide? You know?
Well, the pictures are on the internet. People can just Google it. You know, rusty bread, a potato, a piece of carrot, for instance. And so they'd been given the budget to provide, but they'd chosen not to do so. So privatization is a big issue. Mm-hmm. And of course, the macro stuff that the professor alluded to, Brexit being a huge preoccupation.
Sure.
So I suspect this issue is actually going to get much worse. And the historical trajectory supports that argument, because the UK has been on this trajectory now for 40 plus years. I don't expect to see them come off the ramps just yet.
Okay, thank you for that. We appreciate both Mohan and Professor Gordon there. Now we're about to take a quick break here on Economic Divide. Welcome back to Economic Divide with me, Kavita Tapwai. Time now to take a deeper look at the UK child food crisis in Britain in our in-depth section. One of the most disturbing stories to emerge, particularly for the British government, is the action being taken by UNICEF, who, for the first time, has had to step in and feed Britain's children. For the first time in 70 years, the UN agency will help fund food parcels, helping to supply at least 18,000 meals to children across Britain. Now, the political ramifications of UNICEF stepping in is a huge embarrassment to the Conservative government, with Deputy Labour leader Angela Rayner actually stating that the fact UNICEF is having to step in to feed the country is a disgrace to Boris Johnson and Chancellor Rishi Sunak, who should be ashamed, indeed something that has left them red-faced. But it seems that the UK government is splitting the inequality gap wider than ever, as it simply refuses to tax the super-rich into paying to reduce the poverty levels in Britain, with the likes of Boris Johnson, Rishi Sunak, and Jacob Rees-Mogg, all multimillionaires, seems that the class system in Britain is designed to solely favor the elite. Yet with food packages still arriving unfit for purpose, it seems that the children of Britain living below the poverty line are stuck with food packages as seen on your screens and as you see over here, with two children designed to being fed for 1 week. Well, this raises the question as to just how parents are expected to manage as things go from bad to worse. Well, time now to take a look at our final report today, which examines just what the British government is doing to solve the problem.
It's amazing to think that the current government of the British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, won an election giving him an 80-seat majority in Parliament. The main surge in support for Johnson came from the voters in the so-called Red Wall area, who were once traditional Labour voters from a working-class background and lived in one of the poorest deciles of poverty in Britain, lulled into voting for the Tories under the false pretext of getting Brexit done. Yet now that Johnson has his feet firmly and securely under the table of the desk at Downing Street, when the poorest people in Britain needed their leader the most, he soon forgot who put him in his place and just how he got there. As a quarter of the British population fall into poverty, with nearly 5 million of those being classified as living in extreme poverty, what then has the government of Boris Johnson done to alleviate the problem? The short answer is not enough. Many people in Britain who are now considered to be in poverty were not in this position prior to Brexit or the COVID-19 pandemic. Yet the schemes designed by the government to save businesses and jobs appears to have fallen short of the goal, as furlough schemes and food packages have all shown to be failures as budgets limit the positive impact on dealing with the issue. It's hence why so many people in Britain have turned to non-governmental sources of assistance and sees Britain relying on the charity of local groups and individuals to see them through the dark tunnel of poverty. In particular, when it comes to school children stuck at home with no food to eat.
So now here we are now back feeding. Today's almost 50, but we've got another school talking to me this afternoon, and they're on about another 30 odd children coming on board from tomorrow.
Even charities and goodwill organisations, such as the one being run by Richmond Rugby Club, are baffled at how the government is failing to act, stating that they could not just sit back and let children go hungry.
Yeah, the politics, that's for the politicians, obviously. We don't want to politicise it, but we've just reacted to something we were doing in the summer. And the thought of kids going hungry over this week and maybe over Christmas as well. Yeah, we can't sit here and do nothing.
With the likes of Boris Johnson, Jacob Rees-Mogg and Rishi Sunak, all well into the multi-millionaires club, it seems that the economic divide between the rich and poor in Britain is doomed to grow ever wider and deeper. Until, of course, the day comes when votes are required and suddenly the Tories may just find themselves again knocking on the doors of the poor, making promises that they're just unable to keep.
Back in the studio is Mohan Abedin and Professor David Gordon from the University of Bristol. Mohan, welcome back.
Welcome.
Professor, last question. Measures that are being taken by the UK government and UK-based charities to resolve child hunger. Please tell us. I mean, can you give any examples of what is being done to improve poverty conditions, particularly when it comes to children?
Well, the government has invested because of the pandemic, so it's introduced a furlough scheme, so most of the people who would likely have become unemployed have not done so, although of course there are gaps in the safety net, and unemployment has more than doubled, although it's still at a much lower rate than it would have been, and they have increased the benefits. Of course, charities have stepped up and religious organisations, and there's now been mass rollouts of food banks and collections for people who are having food insecure to go and get food so they can feed themselves and their children. But we have seen an increase in destitution. We have seen an increase in children going to bed hungry, things which never used to exist 20 years ago and shouldn't exist today. It is an embarrassment. There should be no child going to bed hungry in the UK. There should be no family dependent on food banks. And this has to change.
Well, David Gordon, thank you so much, Professor of Social Justice and Director of the Bristol Poverty Institute at the University of Bristol.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome.
Rest of your share.
Well, Well, Mahan, we heard the professor there, and of course, I'd like to find out from you now in the final question. The current government, British government, is made up of an Oxbridge of millionaires only club. How on earth can they claim that they can feel the pain some of these children are going through in terms of the food poverty that they're experiencing, and then come out and say that we're trying to help them?
Well, the government being made up of elites, again, that's not a new thing in the UK. It's a long-standing cultural thing. And it's just the tip of the iceberg. Look, I fully concur with your guess. This shouldn't be happening. But I fear it will go on happening because, as I stated before, it's not just a political issue. There's ideology here, and there's also culture. So I don't envisage the UK getting on top of this problem. They have all the resources to do it, but they won't, because you know there's a long-standing, deep belief there that their state simply shouldn't be doing this.
All right, thank you so much. We appreciate that, Mahan. It's good to see you again. Mahan Abedin in the studios with us. Also, thanks Professor Gordon from the University of Bristol again for his input into the program. Food poverty in the UK is a bitter pill to swallow for the authorities. On the one hand, many children are going to bed with empty stomachs, wondering where their next meal is going to come from, whilst those are being given some form of aid are left disappointed by inadequate portions and unbalanced diets. For those in the lowest deciles of poverty who do eat, 12% of 4 to 5-year-olds are obese, not from overeating, but from eating processed and fatty foods, many of which are the cheapest and most readily available on the supermarket shelves. With pressure now mounting on the government to resolve the situation, food insecurity in Britain comes with a huge human cost, price that the current generations in the UK will likely carry with them for the rest of their lives, affecting their health, their well-being, and their futures. Don't forget, we want to hear your thoughts on this or any other topic, so do write in and let us know what you think. But for now, that's about all the time we have on this week's show. So on behalf of myself, Kovit Tapley, and the whole team here on Economic Divide, stay safe.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 18, 2019 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, during a meeting with the people of East Azerbaijan. The meeting was held at Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya in commemoration of the anniversary of Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, all praise is due to Allah, the Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master and Prophet, Abul Qasim al-Mustafa Muhammad, and upon his pure, immaculate, chosen, infallible, and purifying household, especially the one remaining with Allah on earth. You're very welcome, dear brothers, dear sisters, and ulama, outstanding personalities, honorable families of martyrs, and enthusiastic and peerless youth of Tabriz. Indeed, the people of Tabriz, in particular, the youth of that city, are unique and peerless in the country. I am very happy to have thankfully had the opportunity to meet you at this Husseiniya on one of the days of Allah, the 29th of Bahman, which is truly one of the days of Allah. First of all, I would like to say that this day of Allah was created by the people of Tabriz. Days of Allah are days during which Allah the Exalted manifests Himself in a special manner. Sometimes, people's intentions, determination, and willpower create such days. The people of Tabriz created this day on the 29th of Bahman of 1356 with their determination and insight. I will expand on this matter later on. Of course, that was not the first time, and it was not the last time either.
Your light and love, all I see. Nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
Our recent history is imbued with the important participation of the people of Tabriz and Azerbaijan on important matters and in significant and determining events. If you look at the post-revolutionary era, the first events after the revolution, of course, you do not remember those days. The people of Tabriz worked a miracle in the true sense of the word. The plot which had been orchestrated by the enemy in Tabriz was foiled by the people of Tabriz themselves, and they did so in the best way possible. Everyone was worried about what would happen in Tabriz. The anti-revolutionary enemies had assembled their troops with the aim of separating Tabriz from the revolution. However, Imam said that the people should not be worried, because the people of Tabriz will respond to them on their own. And this was exactly what would happen. Later on, during the Sacred Defense era and the subsequent events, after that, in the year 1388 and following that, on the 9th of day, the whole country staged a demonstration on the 9th of day, but the people of Tabriz did so on the 8th of day, One day sooner than everyone else, the people of Azerbaijan thankfully played a leading role.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
The brawl between amateur investors and Wall Street professionals began with hedge funds and big corporations shorting the stock or betting on several small companies' fall of share prices. That captivated people's attention on social media, and in the wake of it, online campaigns led to the buying of the company's stock with the aim of pushing up the price. Companies like GameStop were shorted by hedge funds and were labeled as failing by big investors. However, the online movement dramatically soared prices with its stock, trading between $112 and $480 a share. That's up from around $18 a share a few weeks ago. That's while some investors were also hoping to make a quick buck and others seeking to squeeze the hedge funds. The movement cost hedge funds and other big investors dearly, causing investment platforms such as Robinhood to put a ban on trading stock for GameStop, AMC, BlackBerry Limited, the Nokia Corporation, and several other companies, which resulted in shares to fall by 50%. This ignited protests outside the company's California headquarters and in the Manhattan banking district yesterday. Also, groups of angry protesters gathered in front of New York's stock exchange and chanted, "I want my money, and I want it now." They were also holding up signs which read, "Tax Wall Street and tax the rich." The act of restricting stock trade sparked lawsuits and called for investigations from lawmakers. Consequently, the Robinhood's co-founder, Vlad Tenev, announced that the suspension of trading of the stocks will be lifted, though only a limited amount of shares could be traded under the company's supervision. He also rejected the notion that this act is in favor of the hedge funds. The war between amateur investors and Wall Street has caused mayhem in the US stock market, with professional investors calling stock movements being obviously disconnected from fundamentals. However, how powerful are the big corporations? And can they restrict investors from buying shares and stopping individuals gaining a slice of the cake?
I think what we're seeing is people are extremely frustrated because a subgroup of people on Reddit have been able to game the system of Wall Street in their favor against billion-dollar hedge fund managers, and they're finally seeing a clamoring for regulation all of a sudden on Wall Street now that it's the people at the top that are being affected. For decades, for centuries, the Wall Street fat cats have been able to profit off the misery of others. They've made billions, trillions of dollars. They've gotten bailouts. They've done speculative measures. They've profited off of the misery of others, and yet nothing has happened.
Regulators in the United States have warned that the situation is under their scrutiny following a number of share trading platform suspension of trade stocks of the GameStop company and several other firms. One of these share trading platforms is Robinhood, a company that's been accused of gamifying share trades. Robinhood is also under fire for its decision to suspend trading and has sparked outrage among investors who accuse the firm of working in favor of hedge funds and big Wall Street investors who are losing millions of dollars to an army of novice traders. The anger has now spread beyond the investment community, with US politicians joining the backlash against Wall Street. Democratic Representative Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez has called the restriction unacceptable, calling for more details to be published on Robinhood's decision. She also criticized suspending retail investors from purchasing stocks, while hedge funds are free to trade as they wished.
People are upset. People are upset that they have been able to outsmart those on Wall Street and turn a bigger profit for themselves. Some people were able to turn $30,000 into $1 million, etc. They want to continue to be able to do that, and they see this as an attack on the free market. Obviously, the market has never been free, and it continues to be a game that's completely rigged. But I think the defining point is the fact that finally the free market was able somehow to be used to help those who are more at the bottom than more at the top, and obviously you have the free market intervening to prevent this from happening further.
It seems that the online mania to steal from the rich and give to the poor has been betrayed by Robin Hood, who seems to be the real sheriff of Nottingham in this case. However, the fury against control of the system of big corporations and hedge funds has left people with no choice but to unite. But could the army of novice investors win a battle against the Goliath of big corporations and hunt down the real wolves of Wall Street?
The coronavirus pandemic has become an endless nightmare for much of the world. Despite the development and distribution of a range of new vaccines, many countries are still struggling to battle the deadly waves of the highly transmissible disease. As the world steps up efforts to contain the deadly virus, new variants are rapidly replacing older versions, making the situation even more frightening. Many thousands of people lose their lives every day worldwide, despite restrictive measures that have paralyzed economies. The pandemic could get much worse before it gets better. The world is undoubtedly eager to find out how the whole thing began so that future risks can be minimized. The origin of COVID-19 has been a major bone of contention, especially between the world's worst coronavirus-hit country, the United States, and China, where the deadly virus was first detected in December 2019. The two sides have exchanged barbs over the origin of the crisis. Now all eyes are focused on a fact-finding mission on the origins of the pandemic. A team of scientists from the World Health Organization is right now in the Chinese city of Wuhan, trying to find out the origins of the outbreak. The WHO says its fact-finding mission in Wuhan is purely scientific, but the probe is facing a political minefield. The World Health Organization team will carry out on-the-ground investigations into the source of the new coronavirus. The WHO scientists will visit different places in Wuhan and talk to people and officials. The WHO says all hypotheses are on the table during the probe. The WHO team is expected to inspect a seafood market in Wuhan, which was linked to many of the first COVID-19 cases in December 2019. The scientists will also visit hospitals that treat coronavirus patients in the city. But how much will the team of investigators be able to uncover? The WHO experts face a tough task as the city has been repeatedly disinfected. The investigation is ongoing in Wuhan, but there have been cautions against expecting any breakthroughs soon. It could take years before any firm conclusions can be reached. What's making the WHO mission even tougher is the fact that it has been highly politicized. Several countries, particularly the United States, accuse the Chinese government of hiding the outbreak's severity during its early stages. The administration of former U.S. President Donald Trump kept criticizing China for alleged failures in containing the outbreak and refusing to tell the truth. The WHO itself was branded by Trump as a, quote, puppet of China. The Chinese government has dismissed Western allegations, saying the virus might have begun outside of China. Trump is now gone, but the White House is keeping up pressure on Beijing. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki expressed concern this week about what she called misinformation coming out of China. Beijing has warned against any negative speculation and politicized interpretation of the fact-finding mission. Will the WHO scientists be able to carry out their investigation properly despite all the political pressure?
Obviously, the scientific medical investigation may help for future prevention or development of science in terms of understanding how viruses change and how the pandemic started and how the new virus originated. Obviously, among scientists, or at least the majority of scientists, believe what happened is a natural mutation of the virus.
Observers believe that the scientists should be allowed to complete their work independently because the results could prove vital for the future of mankind.
What was planned by the Dutch government as a system to prevent the rapid spread of the COVID-19 virus in the Netherlands has turned sour, as it seems that the curfew imposed has been met with staunch opposition, with four nights of rioting taking place across the country, causing shops to be looted, infrastructure to be damaged, and police having to react to contain the disturbance. With police facing rioters on the front line, water cannons, CS gas, and other forms of police force have had to be deployed, resulting in hundreds of arrests being made and fines allocated to those who break the curfew rules. Yet it seems after four nights of violence involving a crowd formed by a majority of youths, the police have managed to take hold of the situation as protests have died down as the consequences of the actions of the rioters are being met with a tough stance by the police and the government. In fact, the reaction by the Dutch government is one of anger, as it claims that all damage will be paid for by those responsible. A tough task to apply, but something that the government of Mark Rutte is keen to go through with, as echoed by the Dutch finance minister, who has labelled the rioters as scum. Many of the protests and rioters are complaining about the measures being taken by the Dutch government when it comes to containing and dealing with the virus, claiming a curfew still does not eradicate the virus. But many in the Netherlands do not agree with the protests, stating that only a small minority of people are causing so much trouble.
Well, we're very sorry about it. It's just really unfortunate, actually. I have a feeling that most of these people, not all of them, some are genuine protesters against corona rules, right? But most of them are just people who usually attend football matches and just are looking for rioting, etc. And that's really unfortunate. I mean, that's just not what all of the Netherlands is. I mean, this is just like 0.1% of population, or maybe 0.01% of population. It's very unfortunate that it gets such a lot of international attention.
With a country very much like the rest of Europe, impatient to get the vaccines rolled out, hence allowing life to return to some kind of normality, it remains to be seen what will happen until then. However, deep in the mix of the protests, yet still visible enough to be seen, it seems that the protests and riots are a stage for another form of demonstration in the Netherlands, one that may yet again rise its ugly head in the near future. Many countries across the world have seen the effects of the pandemic affect their social well-being, causing many people to reach boiling point, as over 12 months of hardship has seen the world change the way it performs, even the most benign of duties. Yet worryingly, in the Netherlands, pockets of protests have included political groups, which most concerning of all, contain far-right movements, with evidence suggesting that the Dutch branch of the German-born Pegida ideology has been counted amongst the protesters. The Netherlands has a strong far-right influence in its political parties, and this has been reflected by some far-right politicians calling on the Dutch military to step in and protect the streets of the country against the rioters, something that suggests the current plan to control the situation by the police may just not be enough, in spite of a calmer last day or two. But the Netherlands, as we know, has a strong anti-immigrant and in particular anti-Muslim following, inspired by the likes of far-right leader Geert Wilders, who in his past rhetoric has made his feelings very clear about certain communities living in the country.
Look at the Islamization of our country. If a Dutch person driving in a car drives 5 miles too fast, he will be fined within a minute, whereas the Moroccan scum in Holland, and once again, not all are scum, but there is a lot of Moroccan scum in Holland who makes the streets unsafe, mostly young people, and they are not taken seriously. We are making them and the people unsafe, and that should change.
With far-right groups such as Pediger now emerging in the shadows of the protests, could this openly public sentiment fall into the hands of far-right leaders such as Geert Wilders, who may use the surge in feelings to fuel his campaign to bring the far-right up another notch on the political spectrum, especially as the Dutch are due to face an upcoming election following the resignation of current Prime Minister Mark Rutte following a welfare payment scandal. There's no doubt that far-right groups across Europe are still very much in place, and although the COVID-19 virus has played its part on diverting attention away from politics for now, could the example seen in the Dutch protests and riots be the catalyst for other far-right groups in Europe to jump on the bandwagon and politicise the virus to their own benefits?
January 26th is remembered by many Australians as a national day, with many celebrating the occasion with pomp and show to mark the anniversary of the 1788 arrival of a group of British ships called the First Fleet at Port Jackson in New South Wales and the raising of the British flag at Sydney Cove by Arthur Phillip. The part of the celebrations was hoisting an Australian flag over Sydney's Opera House and displaying the word Austay on the sky over the Sydney Harbour. But the celebrations of the origins of a modern nation are a time of mourning for Indigenous Australians who have endured discriminations despite inhabiting the land for centuries. They view the arrival of British settlers 200 years ago as the beginning of pain and suffering. They even brand the Australia Day as Invasions Day. That's why thousands of people, mainly Indigenous, defied coronavirus restrictions on Tuesday and took to the streets in several cities to highlight their plight. Some protesters chanted a slogan such as "Sovereignty was never ceded" and "No justice, no peace," while others held up placards reading "Not a day to celebrate" and "Black lives matter."
It's very important because the issues that we're facing here in Australia are not going to go away overnight. So until we start getting justice and start seeing change in this country, we will not stop. This will be continuous. We no longer call it Australia Day, it's now Invasion Day. Always was and always will be Invasion Day.
But why do Indigenous Australians view this auspicious day as Invasions Day?
There's a much wider recognition these days of the 26th of January as an Invasion Day or a Survival Day, because at least for the last generation or so, younger people have learnt that the colonisation of this country was not simply a matter of settlement, it was a matter of brutal dispossession, it was a matter of genocide, it was a matter of trying to obliterate the culture of Indigenous people here. And at least for the last 30 or so years, there's been a recognition every year and some greater recognition in schools and universities of that sort of history. So there is now, as a result, this very strong tension between the ongoing celebration of colonisation called Australia Day and the recognition of Survival or Invasion Day, which is an important educative influence over younger people in this country.
Australia Day, which was formally declared a national holiday only in 1994, has increasingly heightened heated debates in recent years. The occasion is staunchly defended by right-wing commentators and retains strong support from the country's conservative government. Prime Minister Scott Morrison believes history changed forever in 1788 and that there was no escaping or cancelling that fact. He says for the better and worse, it was the moment where the journey to modern Australia began. But federal opposition leader Anthony Albanese has a totally different reading of the whole historical journey. This is Australia Day, is the one Australians need to acknowledge that it has been a very difficult day for the First Nations people.
In the first instance, it's important for us to recognise our own history and the consequences of our own history and the fallout of that colonisation and dispossession and the way in which the non-Aboriginal communities benefited from that and still benefit from that and the ongoing enormous social advantage against Indigenous people in this country, which far outweighs that of any other community. So if we don't understand our own history, we can't have a resolution of contemporary problems. Secondly, because Australia is involved in a lot of adventures, a lot of neocolonial adventures in other countries, we can't recognise the problems of that and the problems of our own intervention in other countries unless we understand our own history and the colonisation of our own history.
Australia's Aboriginals currently represent around 3% of the country's population, but the most disadvantaged lot of the society. They are also said to be largely excluded in their limited capacity to participate in the decision-making or even control their own and mainstream social and cultural environment. From forcible suppression of children from their families to their being displaced from their land, limited education, and inadequate employment, discrimination has been widely reported by advocacy groups. But how has the Australian Indigenous population been marginalized even to the present day?
Well, there's been enormous disadvantage. It occurs across the board. For example, Aboriginal people in prison are something like 14 to 15 times overrepresented. In education, there's been enormous disadvantage. In health, there's terrible disadvantage. As I said, there's no other ethnic group or community that is nearly as disadvantaged as Aboriginal people, despite the fact that large amounts of money have been spent on particular programs. But they haven't achieved success because there's a very deep cultural alienation, for example, from the institutions and the educational institutions of Australia.
All in all, what needs to be done is for the Australian government to put an end to the misery of the Indigenous people and take steps to make it not look like they're from another planet.
The very first revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
جانم تپشم سخنم باشد وطنم وطنم ای خان که گوهر خیز بهره وطنم قدمم عشقم سخنم قسمم از عاشقی لبری.
Congratulations on the victory anniversary of the Islamic Revolution.
Islamic Revolution, solution to crisis of spirituality. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, today is the second day of the 10-day dawn, which marks the period in which the Islamic Revolution of the Iranian people triumphed over the oppressive Pahlavi regime and put an end to 2,500 years of tyranny and oppression for good. Today we are going to touch upon another important feature of the Islamic Revolution, namely the solution to the crisis of modern man through revival of spirituality. Stay tuned, please. One of the most important features of the Islamic Revolution is that it triumphed by reliance on religion. This was while Marxism, as a prevalent ideology in those years, described religion as the opium of masses and justifier of oppression of rulers. The Islamic Revolution proved that, depending on the teachings of Islam, a nation can stage uprising against the tyranny of rulers and bring about freedom and social justice. The Islamic Revolution revived religion and spirituality at a time that contemporary human being had been alienated from himself through technology and consequences of technology. Of course, the Islamic Revolution has not been opposite to technology and sciences, but it has tried to show the true picture of technology and ills of modernism. Experts maintain that, although modernism has brought achievements for mankind, it has deprived him from many natural needs, especially spirituality and inclination to worshipping the source of creation. Some experts believe that the modern man's crises are of two categories. The first consists of those crises which are the result of man's opposition with himself and God. The second group includes those crises which stem from man's opposition with the society and the world. Opposition with oneself and God causes crises of identity and makes man totally isolated. Today, the dominance of instrumental rationality has marginalized human emotions, and human being has failed to create a balance between reasoning and emotions. Materialism, hedonism, and utilitarianism have led human being to skepticism. This has ultimately led to nihilism, which is manifested in suicide and myriads of social ills. The lack of balance in individuals' relations with the society and the environment has caused a lot of crises. Excessive enjoyment of nature as the source of man's welfare has led to severe environmental crises and has put man in the brink of annihilation. The generation gap has intensified in various societies, and family, as the main unit and trench of social life, has been put at the threshold of disintegration. Moreover, excessive pursuit of carnal pleasures and extravagant consumerism have made human life far from modernism. Such an individual will not think of his ultimate fate and won't have any ideal. This has led to psychological turmoil, which in turn leads to crimes, divorce, suicide, and a plethora of other ills. The current modernism has resulted in depression and dissatisfaction of the individual towards life. Now the question which has occupied the minds of pundits and researchers is this: why have progresses in various sciences been unable to overcome this magnitude of crises? And what is the solution? The Islamic Revolution emerged in the current crisis-hit world as a novel pattern for human life. One of the outstanding features of this revolution has been the revival of spirituality. Thus, Imam Khomeini was indeed the reviver of spirituality in the 20th century. He introduced Islam as a perfect religion which pays attention to the minutest dimensions of mankind and meets each and every need of him. The Imam strongly believed that Islam is the most suitable model for arrangement of human life and setting up a rule due to its simultaneous emphasis on intellect and religion. Imam Khomeini said, "Islam is the source of human salvation. Islam has come for building human being. It has come, unlike ungodly elements, to take human beings to light." Elsewhere in his remarks, he said, We should try to invite people to spirituality and Islamic morality. Many might think that material welfare and having properties or real estate and the like will bring salvation for human being, but this is a mistake that man makes. Imam Khomeini also wrote in his last testament, "We and our nation have the honor of following a religion which has rescued Quranic realities that thoroughly speak of unity among Muslims and even mankind from graves, and as the greatest savior has salvaged mankind from the fetters that have been tied around his feet, hands and heart, to drag him toward destruction and slavery of ungodly rulers." Imam Khomeini maintained that revival of spirituality is not limited to the individual life, and it includes the whole ruling system. It should be manifested in the conduct of officials in every section. The Imam illustrated the principles and structure of popular religions, which differs a lot from the liberal democracy preached by the West, and is in fact more democratic than any democratic rule that mankind has experienced in the West so far. He used to warn the officials against being plunged in materialism and seeking worldly pleasures as the cause of decline of the Islamic rule. Imam Khomeini considered achievement of freedom, independence, justice, progress, and building of civilization alongside spirituality and morality as the main message of the Islamic Revolution. He strongly believed that development and progress without morality and spirituality would lead to ungodly rule. He was boastful of defending the oppressed and downtrodden throughout the world and fought against oppressors. His thoughts had impacted thinkers like Michel Foucault too. The French thinker was a serious critic of modernity and maintained that modernity is based on the separation of progress from morality. Foucault opined that the Islamic Revolution has proved the failure of modernity. He said that the Islamic Revolution has filled the spiritual vacuum and breathed a new spirit in the body of human societies. He maintained that the Western civilization has denoted mankind of spirituality and genuine identity. He said that the Islamic Revolution posed the greatest challenge against the Western civilization and shook its foundations.
Around the world with reporters.
Protesters have taken to the streets in dozens of French cities against a security bill they say will restrict the filming and publicizing of images of police brutality. Demonstrators said the draft legislation will lead to more censorship and less freedom.
This bill has one objective, to allow a surveillance of the territory by drones. We are, of course, against the ban for journalists to film and to publish pictures of police officers. They want to prevent the publication of footage of police violence. The citizens say we don't want this law at all.
A total of 70 groups, including the Yellow Vests, organized the protest. Protesters said the new law opens the door to a generalized surveillance of the population, the use of drones, and the ban to film police officers.
We have been experiencing police violence for a long time, in the suburbs more than elsewhere. There is more and more violence during demonstrations. The citizens should understand that we are here to defend their future liberty and the right to film. We must be able to show the judges that sometimes there is police violence. Pictures are sometimes the only evidence.
Footage of white police officers beating up a black music producer in his Paris studio on November 21 has fueled anger over the legislation, condemned by many as signaling a swing to the right by President Emmanuel Macron.
We've got for a